because he's looking. He's met lepers before. He's got a beautiful mother and a beautiful father who by this time is dead, because the Gospels talk about his mother now, but not Joseph, so presumably he died, or we know he died. So he's at home with mum, looking after her after dad died, and all that. But he's looking for something, and he finds it in this, because of course he's looking for it, he's human, and he finds it here. When? What happened? The heavens, we're told this, very brief, the heavens were torn apart. And I imagined that as a kid, because I got a holy card from Sister Maria Joseph. And it had Jesus, and it had one of those, whoosh, like you see sometimes, don't you? The heavens, and the light is coming out just, and that's what I imagined happened. The heavens were torn apart. Anyhow, that's it. And the Spirit descended on Jesus like a dove. Well, I thought it was a dove that descended on him, but it's not. It's like a dove. So we've got to have a pretty good look at that. It's the Spirit of God descending on Jesus. Well, I imagined, because the holy card had it, didn't it? A dove, kind of up above, and just, well, Jesus didn't look up, or he might have got more than the Spirit.
Yes.
So he might have been like Job, you know. Who was it, Job? No, the other bloke. Jonah. No. Who am I thinking of? Oh, my brain's gone. Who was the bloke who went blind?
Tobit.
Oh, thank God you're here. Tobit. So he might have done that. And a voice came from heaven. You are my son, the beloved. With you I am well pleased. So it's our first lesson in how to read the gospel. Had you had a tape recorder there, or a video better, you would have seen all this, would you? Of course not. So we'll go through it slowly. The heavens were torn apart. Here's Isaiah 64. Oh, the disciples back in Jerusalem, and it's all tightening up. They've come back from exile. This is the last part of Isaiah, disciples. And they've come back from exile, and all the people who are important with all the power are making sure this will never happen again. So they're getting everybody to make sure they do everything right. So if you've got a Moabite wife, you have to send her back to Moab. You have to be pure. Ethnic cleansing went on. And everything else went on so they wouldn't put a foot wrong with God. Well, if you don't put a foot wrong with God, the likelihood is you haven't put a foot anywhere. You're just stuck. Because every time you take a step, it could be wrong, couldn't it? So you're just there, making sure you don't do anything wrong. Well, if that's what life's about, let's all die and be done with it. So this story says, the disciples of Isaiah, who were wonderful fellows, are kind of crying out against all this legalism and tightness, and they're saying, I'll read to you. Oh God, that you would tear the heavens open and come down, so that the mountains would quake at your presence, as when the fire kindles brushwood and the fire causes water to boil, to make your name known to your adversaries, so that the nation might tremble at your presence. They're wanting God to come and do something about this religious mess they're in. When you did awesome deeds that we did not expect, you came down and the mountains quaked at your presence. Remember Mount Sinai? From ages past, no one's heard, no ear has perceived, no eye has seen any God beside you who worked for those who wait for him. You meet those who gladly do right, and on it goes. And then at the end it says, how can you keep silent while we're crying out to you the way we are? Well, Mark is telling us, because everyone reading Mark, all the Jews and the people who are attached to the synagogue who weren't Jews, who they were the first Gentiles to become Christians, the heavens were torn apart. God answered that prayer at the baptism of Jesus. At last, we've got someone who knows God and will not have anything to do with all that religious, whatever you're going to call it. The Spirit descended on Jesus. I don't have to read this, I'll be here all day, but you know the book of Genesis. The hovered over the waters, of the chaos, it's all waters and darkness, but the Spirit of God hovered over the waters, and God said, let there be light. Let you know all that? So here it's all happening again. Let there be It's like, but it, the Spirit of God over Jesus was like a dove. Very gentle. What? Nothing like. Read all the prophets. You've got only 5 days to do nothing else. Read the whole lot of them and you won't find anything like this in them. They were, the Messiah was going to be like a lion roaring in the desert. He was going to be like a fire burning up the mountains. He was going to be like, oh, they had these powerful images of, because that's what you expect of God. You know, stunning stuff. Well, this is a dove. And even people as like, I used to be really frightened of dogs because I probably was bitten by one when I was a kid and we didn't have a dog. I'm not so frightened now, I must say, but I've never been frightened of a dove. Does that sound pretty good? Pretty brave? You can't find it. The dove is so gentle, you know, billing and cooing. This is telling you about Jesus' character. Spirit was like a dove. No wonder the leper could come to him, because he was so gentle. I am gentle and humble of heart. We just read it the other day. So, and you think of the dove too, going out of the ark, don't you? And picking up and coming back with the... So it's a new spring, it's a new creation, it's a new beginning of the world, all that's there. The voice came from heaven. This is a quote from Isaiah chapter 42, which I'll show it to you here. This, why did they put, obviously nothing was heard. Jesus, he didn't hear anything particularly. No one did. But after 3 years of living with Jesus, after watching him die, after experiencing the risen Christ and the extraordinary growth of Christianity in the Roman world, the Mediterranean world, all those years of meditation, they couldn't find a better way of summing up the experience of Jesus at the baptism than those words from Isaiah 42, the servant song of Isaiah. You're my son, you're the one I love, I'm well pleased with you. Jesus clearly experienced an overwhelming experience of being loved. He'd always felt it. But as with all of us, you can be loved and then you can be loved and then you can be loved. Like it's not a thing that happens, it just can grow. So this was an overwhelming experience of love. It will take us into the desert, took Jesus into the desert to cope with it, to understand what it means. And you're going to watch, Mark's going to show you Jesus when he comes out of the desert. Jesus realizes that this is what everyone needs to experience. That's exactly, he experienced it and realized that's the, he hadn't met it then, but that's the trouble with Mary of Magdala. She doesn't know how loved she is. So she's caught up with all these hobos. And that's the trouble with the leper. And it's the trouble with the leper's mother and father and everybody that Jesus met and the thief on the cross. They don't know how loved they are. They haven't had this baptism experience of being loved by God, loved out of their poverty into the rich life of God. But let me read to you now from Isaiah 42, and you can see why they quoted it. Here is my servant. The servant is now son, much more intimate. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights, whom I'm well pleased, you could translate it. I've put my spirit upon him. He will establish for the nations an order based on justice. He won't shout or raise his voice. He won't to make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he won't break. A dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will establish an order based on justice. He will not grow faint or be crushed. He's not weak. Until he's established in the earth an order based on justice. And the coastlands are waiting for his Torah. Thus says God, Yahweh, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and what comes from it, who gives breath to the people upon it and spirit to those who walk in it. I, Yahweh, have called you in righteousness. I've taken you by the hand and kept you. I've given you as a covenant to the people, a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring prisoners out from the dungeon, and from the prison those who sit in darkness. Jesus' experience at the baptism was for him, and it was overwhelming, it was wonderful for him, but he also saw this is what everyone needs to know. So it was his mission came out of this, and the whole gospel is about his mission. Telling people that, showing them that, caring for them in that way, so that they'd be free and hopefully become saints. What we've been watching in those first 11 verses is, I'll call it the best name, the divinity of Jesus. In other words, we're focusing on his relationship with God that's intimate, beyond anything anyone had ever experienced, uniquely beautiful, and that's where we're going to find what we mean by his divinity, in there, mysteriously, but beautifully there. To take you to John's Gospel, to chapter 2. So after the prologue and the calling of the disciples and so on, John begins his Gospel with this extraordinarily beautiful and important scene at Cana in Galilee. I'll just read the beginning verses. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me?" Let's pause there for a minute. That's an Aramaic idiom there that you find in different places in the Bible. What's it mean? Woman, so he's speaking to her as woman, symbolic of all women, all the women of the Old Testament that had ever longed for the Messiah. What concern is that to you and me is a way of saying, hold it. It's a balk. It's a stop. It's, do you realize what you're asking? Are you aware of the significance of this moment? Sometimes that goes on and the person refuses to do what they're asked. Sometimes in other texts they actually do it. In this case, Jesus does. He does respond to his mother positively, because she says in a moment to the servants, do whatever he tells you. She's aware he's going to do something. But here just, so there's this balk, there's this question, are you aware of the significance of what's going on? Then he goes on to say, and this is difficult because it's often translated differently to the way I'm going to translate it for you now. It's usually translated, my hour has not yet come. And that's a possible translation of the Greek. It's actually quite reasonable, because later in the Gospel, when they try to capture Jesus, says his hour had not yet come. And again, it comes a bit later, his hour, my hour has not yet come. And then when he comes to the supper, it says the hour has come. And it's a dramatic statement in John that recurs. So it's understandable that they would translate it here, my hour has not yet come. But if it's a question, and in the original text there are no punctuation marks, there's another way of translating, and I'm really confident this is how it should be translated. I think he's saying, has not my hour now come? Has not my hour now come? Now, it's not the complete hour, it's not the complete moment, it's not the full revelation that'll come when he's on the cross and he's from the pierced heart will pour out the wine and the blood and the water. That's when the hour finally comes. But this is the beginning of the hour, the moment of the revelation on the third day. This is where the Spirit starts to flow. And it's he's saying, in a way, this is the moment for the beginning of my ministry. And John puts it right in chapter 2, verse 1. You don't find it in any of the other Gospels, and I think you know the rest of the story, so I'll take it as read. And they go and they take some more, they fill their jars with water, and there are six of them, quite symbolic. And then they draw out some that have been turned into wine. And
But the significance of it is best seen when you go to the next scene. Because John, why does he begin with a wedding banquet? Why does he begin his whole gospel, the ministry of Jesus, with this Cana scene? If you were dramatizing John's gospel, you'd have this as the backdrop on the stage. It'd be there right throughout the gospel, Cana of Galilee. Because straight after it, John brings in something that happened right at the end of Jesus' ministry, the emptying of the temple. And he puts it here in chapter 2. So these are contrasting scenes. John wants us to choose, and in fact from chapter 3 right through to chapter 12 there's a constant struggle. Are we going to believe in Cana, the water turned into wine, or are we going to continue going to the temple and carrying on the beautiful but now come to their conclusion scenes of sacrificial offering in the temple? What's life about? What John's asking, what was Jesus actually communicating? And he wants to give us the idea that actually Jesus was about a wedding banquet. People were good at doing temple things, institutional things, religious things in those cultures. If one did it, well, everybody did it. It was very hard not to do what the community and many cultures are still like that. So, yeah, the temple is fine and people are used to doing it, but it's done its job. It's come to something else. There's now another temple here, the temple of Jesus' body, the temple of the community. He's come to a whole new awakening and a new fulfilling of what was going on. And it's a wedding banquet, because we're not so good at knowing we're loved. We're not so good at realizing that life is meant to be a wedding banquet, that God is a bridegroom. Jesus calls himself the bridegroom. God is the lover, and the water is all our human, wonderful human stuff, but it's got to be transformed, it's got to be awakened. We need the wine, which is, of course, symbolically the Spirit, poured into our hearts. We need God's love to embrace us in this wedding banquet of life. So it raises the question, naturally, what have we got here? Do we have a description of a thing, something that actually happened in Cana at the beginning of Jesus' ministry? Of course, perhaps. We're not limiting. I'm not saying we're not doing that. But I think it's questionable. I think what we're more dealing with here is John's asking, how do I communicate to these people here in Ephesus? How do I tell them the importance of love? God is love. How do I almost shock them into a new way of liberation, a new way of loving, which is so demanding, but real, and about life and living to the full? And could John have created this scene? Jesus went to many weddings, I'm sure everybody did. There were public events in their culture. So here's my mother and his disciples, and he would have gone to weddings. Did he actually ever change physical water into physical wine? Is that what we're being told in this scene? I don't want to say no, but I don't want to say yes either. I think it's when you look at the drama of the gospel and see this scene contrasted with the emptying of the temple, we're much more likely to be dealing with a parable, a story. They're a storytelling culture. All the Bible is full of stories, because that's the way they told it. It's the way many cultures still do it. Tell what's important to them. So couldn't this be a story? Couldn't it be a kind of a life parable, if you like? Like the story of the prodigal son, or the story of the Good Samaritan. Or this is a story about Jesus intending to take us where only the lover can go, to take us where John came, something that he came to see about the very essence of Jesus' ministry. What happened at Cana happened every day of Jesus' life. He was always changing, inverted commas, water into, inverted commas, wine. He was also transforming people's lives and transforming the whole world, really, and transforming by love, by pouring out the wine of God's Spirit into people's lives. He was changing their water into wine. I can't put it better than that. But and this scene with the mother, the woman there, the only other time the woman, that's his mother Mary, of course, is mentioned in John's Gospel, is right at the end when the hour has finally come, and there she is standing at the foot of the cross. Now, a symbol of every woman of the New Testament, every disciple, every mother who wants her children to live and live to the full and enjoy the wedding banquet that life is meant to be. So we're dealing with powerful symbolism and dramatic presentations. How the question, come back to it, is how would a gospel writer communicate what he and his community had come to see about the meaning of Jesus over 40, in John's case, 60 years of living and loving and catechesis and life? How can you do it? Well, you don't only do it, of course, we've already seen that. You present the events, it's all based on what Jesus really did and really said, but it's presented now in a powerful, dramatic form to communicate not what the eye sees or the ear hears, but what the heart comes to know. And it's done in a most dramatic way. I want to begin by showing you again that slide. The bottom left-hand side is Jesus, obviously, and it's the disciples of Jesus, men and women, who got to know him intimately. Many strange experiences happened to them that were not very comprehensible. If you think of Peter, you can think of the agony in the garden, which totally bewildered him. Others were just beautiful and lovely and divinely obvious. But they kept pondering during those 2-3 years of Jesus' public ministry the meaning, who is he? And more they came to see that the only answer they could find to that was his communion with God. He was the Son of God. His life came from God. God was the source of everything he did. His whole being and thoughts and decisions and agenda and so on. So, and more than that, but that's what they're pondering. Then comes the second picture there, is the crucifixion, obviously. And that must have jarred, it totally jarred poor Judas, who had all kinds of ideas of what the Messiah should be that he hadn't quite let go, and now this happens. But it bewildered the others too. They ran away and couldn't quite cope, and you know all that. But there's the beloved disciple and the mother there at the foot of the cross, loving him and being loved by him. And then the years after that, the experiences that we associate with the resurrection, the resurrected Jesus experiences, post-crucifixion experiences of Jesus, they kept pondering all that too, and different ones would come in and say what their experience was on their way to Emmaus or at the graveside or whatever. They keep pondering that for years and years, and then they'd read the scriptures, and the scriptures would give them a further insight. They'd read a psalm and they'd think, oh, that really picks up beautifully what happened to Jesus here or there or somewhere. And then we come to where we are in this retreat, to Mark's Gospel. And Mark is asked, we read that by the community, and he had a special gift for this, obviously. And with Peter's inspiration guiding him, he wrote a Gospel. For those who knew Jesus, they obviously said, it's not perfect, of course, it's one man's response, inspired response, but not perfect. And hence you've got Matthew and Luke and John and so on, and Paul already. But it's a wonderfully truthful presentation of Jesus that the community picked up and then copied and sent to other people, and so it was accepted by the community as a valid, beautiful expression of the Jesus they knew. And the Jesus that they, those who didn't know Jesus, because he's also writing for them, found in it a place where they could reflect on Jesus' life and ponder the words of Jesus, though there aren't too many of those in Mark, but there's some, and so on. So you've got this wonderful life going on here in the early community. And we've come to a most important section of this gospel. We looked at the healing and liberating word. It's not a chronological account, but it's pretty straightforward. And now we've got the powerful word, and last evening we looked at especially at the sower story and the words of Jesus and how powerful they were. And now we're coming in Mark 4:35 to 6:6 to see the power of the word incarnate in Jesus, the power in action. We're going to watch it happening. Now, to do that, I have to remind you of something again. And we're talking about literary interpretation, so don't hold me to any of this. I mean, I'll give you my best opinion, but that's all it is. It's based on scholarly work, of course. But maybe this will help you. That's a photo, actually, a photo taken by Peter Hendricks, who's an MSc priest. And he took it in Kai Kora, and I've never been there. It's in the South Island, I understand, of New Zealand. And it's a bay, an inlet. And there you see the mountains, then the snow-capped at the top. You see the lake, and you see these two boats, and you see the light. And if you went there today, and the boats were in the same place, which is unlikely, but if you stood there, that's what you'd see. It hasn't been photoshopped, so it's an actual photo of what's visible to the eye. Now, some would look at it and think it beautiful. I must have done that because I've got it on my desktop, thank you, and I've had it there for 15 years or something, and I keep it there. I'm not into variety. I've got something beautiful, hang on to it. So that's a photo. And there'll be many scenes, we've done some of them already in the Gospel, that are quite photographic, if I could put it that way. They're not photos, clearly. They're word paintings, but Jesus was baptized by John in the Jordan. It's a fact, and it's just there. And then we saw about the mother-in-law of Peter, and a healing went on there, extraordinary, but quite simply written, and other stories we've already looked at. To approach those stories, there's methods of doing it that might help you in your prayer, helps me anyhow, and it's quite ancient. It goes right back to the medieval periods, and it's one method of prayer, just suggested to you, and that is this. It has three steps to it. One is to read the scene, just read it, and be an observer. Watch Jesus, watch the leper, watch what happens. But listen for what your body is telling you, not your mind. And mind's important, of course, but we're pretty good at that. We're not so good at the other. Well, I'm not so good at the other. Maybe you are. But get in touch with your body and the feelings and how you find your unstructured, unorganized self responding to it. That's the first step. The second step is to be the person. Be the mother-in-law of Simon, ill from a fever. Be the leper in the scene. Because we are, that's why the scenes are put there. They're not just arbitrary little scenes. They're chosen because they're significant in everybody's life. We're dealing with art here. So be the leper, the outsider. And you go to Jesus there and you say, if you want to, you could heal me of whatever it is, the leprosy, inverted commas, that I'm suffering from or you're suffering from. Be there. And again, stay in touch with your body and listen to what your body's telling you. Because the brain Well, Mayan, and I presume he was, it seems to be pretty common, can easily take over. That's what the Pharisees were doing all the time. They were letting their trained mind control events and their responses to them. They weren't listening or watching really, whereas the ordinary people were, on the whole. The third step is quite a beautiful one, and it's to be Jesus in the scene. Because, you know, Paul said, I live no longer, Christ lives in me. And the Last Supper, Jesus left, we talked about it last night. I've one commandment, please, this is one thing you must do. Love one another with my love. The love I've given you, love one another with that love. So Jesus wants, so we're called to be Jesus. And then we think, well, who are the lepers in my life that might want to come to me? And maybe I can heal them. I, meaning God through me, of course. Maybe, or the people that are sick around me, someone I haven't rung for years, someone who's hurting, and I know, but I haven't really, and maybe I can't connect, but I might be moved in the prayer to connect. At the end of the prayer, I might write a card or ring someone up, or because it's come out of my body memory, Jesus living in me. Well, that's the first. That's kind of photographic. Let's look at the next scene. Clearly, that's not a photo because photos didn't exist at the time of Jesus. But it's pretty simple and straightforward, as many of the passages in the Gospels will be. It's kind of photographic, though it's not claiming the wood looked like that, and it's not claiming anything else particularly, but it pictures in a simple way a fact, the dying of Jesus on the cross. There are a couple of things in it that are needing proving. If you know, like here, for example, the nails are in the wrong place. They're in the hands. Whereas in the crucifixion, Roman terrible crucifixion, they were put in here because if they were there, the weight of the body would just pull them through, you'd just rip apart. So they were put in, and the problem is that the Hebrew word yad, which is often translated hand, is actually from the elbow down. That's one kind of unit. So, yes, he showed them his hands and his feet, or his hands and his side in John. Yeah, but anyhow, so, but we can live with that. It's hardly that significant. The person who painted that painted out of a long tradition and didn't know what we now know. So it's okay, because the main stone, let's get distracted by the minutiae of it. But there it is, a portrait, not a photo, but a portrait that's very lifelike and quickly takes us visually to the event that we know happened on Calvary. But here we come, we're going deeper now. Here we come, and I've showed it to you already in this third icon here. It's a bronze sculpture, and we've got the artist is not taking us to what the eye could see. You'd never see that on Calvary. The dying Jesus there in the dark, but the resurrected, the into your hands I commend my spirit, Jesus, in the bronze, like almost a high priestly act. It's John 17, it's the resurrection of the spirit of Jesus in the very moment of dying. I don't have to tell you what it's about, you can see it. It's quite beautiful and quite amazing, but it's going beyond what the eye could see. Only a lover reflecting on what happened, only the beloved disciple and Mary gradually could see that with their heart, their body, their mind, because it requires a meditation and a faith depth that the eye doesn't get. The high priest standing there laughing at Jesus on the cross couldn't. That wouldn't mean anything to them. But it would to Peter when he came, looked from a distance, as we're told by Luke, and the early church, and you and me. So it's an art form that's taking us further from the visual facts, but deeper into the real fact of what was happening there in Jesus. It's taking us into the mystery, into the heart, into the truth of it, but truth at a, I'll have to say, a deeper level, a more profound level of insight and faith. And a number of, we've seen one particular scene that's like that already in Mark. That's the scene of the baptism of Jesus. Not that he was baptized by John, that's straightforward fact. But when it talks about Jesus' baptism experience, heavens, it's a stunning painting, portrait, word portrait. But what did they do? They went back to Genesis, because they could see this as a new beginning and Jesus is a new Adam. They went back to Isaiah and the cry of the disciples of Isaiah, oh, that you'd break the heavens and come down. And they see that baptism as the coming down. Here it is, God is breaking through the thing. They talk of the dove of Noah and the Noah's ark. They quote Psalm 2, this coronation psalm, you are my son, on this day have I begotten you. They're quoting that. They're also quoting the Isaiah, well, I said that, the psalm of the second Isaiah one about the servant and the mission. And I mean, it's massive. They've piled into this three or four verses the music, the echoes, the prayer, the long traditions from everywhere, so that when we watch Jesus coming up out of the water and in prayer, that much we see. But this, Mark takes us, thanks to Peter, into the prayer of Jesus in a stunningly beautiful way. We wouldn't see that. We wouldn't hear it. You wouldn't pick it up on a tape recorder nor a video. But this is taking you where the beloved disciple learned to go, and we're asked to go, into what really happened at the Jordan River. The conclusion of many years of meditation and the fruit of that baptism experience, which was Jesus' mission, which comes right back to Isaiah chapter 42. I've said all that because I need to be here now, and there's the last little introductory. That's a painting, a bit awkward because I couldn't get a good picture of it, by Raphael. If you ever go to Rome and go to the Pinacoteca, not in the main museum, but the little place at the side, or big enough place, oh, it's a stunningly fantastic painting. And but there's the three disciples up, we'll do this later, up on the Mount Tabor. There's the three of them. There's Jesus floating in prayer, and then you've got Moses and Elijah. And the story is about them. But if you happened to be a fourth person on the mountain and had your video handy, would you have seen Jesus floating? Would you have seen Elijah and Moses looking like that? Does that mean the risen body looks a bit like an ordinary body, this one? If so, well, Paul got it wrong. We don't want to make that conclusion. The risen body is the expression of our spirit, our communion with God, not the expression of our psyche or whatever. So we're not looking at a photo, clearly, but we are looking at an artist's quite beautiful portrayal of a scene in Mark that is itself a portrayal of what was really going on in the prayer of Jesus that these three men experienced mysteriously on the mountain. And they see Jesus then as the fulfillment of the Torah and the prophets. That's its theological meaning. So they're there, but at the end, you remember, they looked and they saw no one but only Jesus. He is what we need. In a sense, we don't need the prophets anymore. Yes, we need them as they're fulfilled in Jesus. So we need Jesus. And then, of course, it's lovely to go back to the prophets and be helped by some of their words to appreciate what we're looking at when we look at Jesus. And we don't need the Torah anymore, as Paul keeps telling us, except as it's fulfilled, flowering, come to its conclusion, correcting, nuancing, amazingly going beyond anything in the Torah, in Jesus. So we were being told by Mark, and that's a scene I'll do with you later, all we need now is Jesus. Let's look at him, because he fulfills all this beautiful journey And he actually sets it right in a way and brings to flowering all the dreaming and hope and inspired journey of the people of God. So now I'm ready to start the lecture. You ready? But I felt in the, I needed to say all that before I could. In their attempt to communicate the significance of Jesus to their Jewish brothers and sisters, the Christian community portrays Jesus as the perfect fulfillment of the faith of Israel. And fulfill doesn't mean join all the dots. Fulfill means like you've got a cactus. I remember seeing this in Papua New Guinea. I was ill at the time and I went up there. My brother was the rector of the seminary and I just happened to be fortunate. It was a full moon night and I came out in the morning and this, I'd have to say ugly, I'm a bit insensitive to, but cactuses look pretty ugly to me anyhow. This cactus, and there was this white lily that had come out of it just that moonlight night. I remember thinking, I'm not that aware or sensate really, but I thought, smoke. Like there seemed to be such a contrast between the spiny thing and then this just delicate flower. I called Jim to come out. He said, oh, you're lucky you saw it. It won't be there. It only lasts. Come. Yeah. And there it was. Well, that's a fulfillment. When you look at Jesus, when you look at the Old Testament, if you look at it first, as the Pharisees did and the Sadducees and everybody in learning of the world, the leaders on the whole, when they look at that, you don't recognise Jesus. What? He's got nothing to do with this. But when you start with Jesus and see the flowering, then you can go back and sort out the cactus and realise that was its whole purpose all along, was to produce this surprising but consistently beautiful Jesus. Now, to do so in a dramatic storytelling tradition of the Old Testament. The Old Testament, they belong to a people that many people belong to. I mean, the Irish are all this. Anyone who's not literate belongs to this kind of tradition, where you tell stories. The Aboriginal tradition is about stories. And the stories, if we were to say, oh, God, they don't know what they're talking about, that's all mythology, then we're the idiots, not them, because they're saying fantastic stuff in their myths, as were the Greeks, as were the Romans, as were the Jews. So it's a story. David, for example, the only thing you know about David is that he existed. We can prove that. Every single thing said about David in the Bible, they're not facts about David. They're about what a leader should be, the ideal leader, but we're broken, we sin. Well, what should we do when we sin? So it's written for the current prime minister or the equivalent in their day. It's about leadership. And so there's stories. What do we know about Samuel? We know he was a prophet. Well, you got him as a little boy, you know, speak, Lord, your servant is listening. They're dreaming and wonderful literature, but not factual stuff, rather truthful stuff, getting to the heart of what our faith, their Jewish faith is. And that storytelling was what Jesus did it too all the time, the parables, because it's storytelling. Well, we might forget that God loves us sometimes, but how do you forget the prodigal son story? I mean, it's just there. You can't, stories are wonderful. Well, here it is. And that's what we're going to see now. We're going to see three stories in the tradition of the Old Testament about the power of God's word in the incarnate Jesus. Let's enjoy it. We're going to watch a scene where external chaos cannot separate us from God's love, a storm at the sea. Now, we've all been in places where it was chaotic all around us. Some of us might see ourselves as a John Wayne figure. You know, we can survive all this chaos around us. Maybe I'm joking, but you know what I mean. Okay, and they do survive the chaos. But then the second scene is when the chaos is inside. What do you do then? What do you do when you're having a nervous breakdown? What do you do when you have a moral collapse? What do you do when everything's not working and inside you're in turmoil or a significant relationship is breaking down, etc., etc.? So what do you do then? Well, it can't separate us from God's love, we're told. We're told that in theory we're going to watch it happen.
And what about death? Death is the ultimate mystery, and maybe death will separate us from the love of God. Some of the Thessalonians were worried about that when Paul left them and went down to Corinth, and then some of their members died, and they thought, well, Jesus hasn't come yet, the end of the world. So they write to Paul and send a message through him. What's the meaning? They were frightened. They thought, well, they've lost. There's no hope for them. And Paul writes back, he tells them about death and whatever in his letters to the Thessalonians. No, this point is that not even death can separate us from God's love. But then it's going to end with a highly dramatic, powerful, tragic scene that we mustn't miss. There is something that can separate us from God's love. Nothing can stop God's love, but it has to be welcomed. And I'm free, as you're free, to welcome it with tiny little opening or a big wide embrace, or to turn our back and walk away or forget or retain our power or whatever. So we're going to see, in spite of all this, God will never stop loving. We weren't all taught that when we were young, and we didn't pick it up anyhow too well. I mean, I think I thought if I committed a mortal sin, then I thought, well, God won't love me anymore or something, unless I go to confession. I mean, so it's like God's changed, you know what I mean? That's a danger anyhow, and perhaps children pick things up a bit difficultly, but I think we were probably taught some of that too without realising it. No, God doesn't change. God is love, period. That's it. God, and by love we mean self-giving. We mean gifting oneself to another. I mean, you could say a whole lot of things about love, but that's the key point, I think. So God will never change. But God, as Jesus says in the Apocalypse, I stand at the door knocking. If you open, I'll come in and sup with you. If you open. Because God's not, love doesn't barge in to my life or your life or anyone's life. It waits gently, wanting, but not controlling. So let's now enjoy these. But begin, though, I'm going to quote from what you said last night, Jeannie, from that, but bits of it anyhow, chapter 8, because this is really behind all that we're going to look at this morning. If God is for us, who's against us? Says Paul, chapter 8, 31. He who did not withhold his own son, but gave him up for us all, will he not with him give us everything else? Who'll separate us from the love of Christ? Hardship? Distress? Persecution? Life brings on all this, but famine, nakedness, peril, sword? And he adds a bit. No, in all these things we're more than conquerors, not because of our own power, but through him who loved us. For I'm convinced, he says, that neither death nor life, no angels, no rulers, no things present, nothing to come, anything in creation, nothing at all, will ever be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus. You know that passage. Well, let's now watch what Mark does with the same insight, thanks to Peter and the early church. Let's begin. Mark 4:35, on that day, evening had come, and he says to them, let's go across to the other side. They're going into the Gentile region. They're going into the darkness. They're leaving the Holy Land, inverted commas, and they're heading to where the unclean are. Leaving the crowd behind, they take him with them in a boat just as he was. It's quite a cute little phrase, just as he was. What does that mean? Was he wearing box shorts or something? Or had his thongs on and wasn't quite, I don't know, just as he was. And that's how we got to take Jesus, because it's a beautiful way to be. And other boats were with them. So they're crossing the sea. The sea is itself chaos. And they're crossing it in a direction that's out of their comfort zone altogether. A great windstorm arises. And you've got to go back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. The darkness and the chaos of the swirling waters fresh and salt water everywhere. And you've got to go back to Noah and the flood, and don't tell me it was an actual flood. There were floods all over the blooming place, some of them massively dramatic, but got nothing to do with the Bible. The Bible is using it as a symbol now, because this flood comes from the collapse of the firmament. The solid, it's not solid, we know, but they thought it was, firmament that collapsed, and all the waters above crashed down onto the waters beneath, and we're back to chaos. We're back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. The whole of creation has been reversed. So it's highly dramatic, wonderful material. Please don't spoil it or let anyone else spoil it for you. If you want to put money into people looking for the ark, well, waste your money. I can give you some better reasons for doing it. It's like looking for Cinderella's slipper. You probably won't find it. A great windstorm arose, so it's crook. The waves were hurling themselves against the boat. And the word there is really quite personal. It's like demonic. It's not just waves. There's a conscious evil going on here. The boat was already being swamped. Now hear that for the first time and be a member of the Jewish community in Rome where it's been written. And that's what's been happening to you when your cousin was torched and tarred and burnt on a cross by Nero's mob. And Peter's been killed and Paul's been killed. And all you ever wanted was peace, and all you ever tried to do was love, and this is what's going on. Well, your whole world is collapsing around you. You're being swamped by it. And then you're in the boat of Peter, the bark of the church, but it doesn't seem to be working for you. Jesus was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. They wake him up and say to him, "Teacher, don't you care that we're perishing?" Jesus woke up, must have been a good sleeper, and he rebuked the wind. Let me read to you from the psalm about the crossing of the Red Sea. He rebuked the Red Sea and it became dry. He led them through the deep as through a desert. He saved them from the hand of the foe, and on it goes. Same word. Just as God rebuked the Red Sea, as though it's alive in a way. It's a symbol of demonic evil power. Well, here's Jesus, so that's behind this language too. He rebuked the wind, and he said to the sea, "Peace, be still." Words that he'd already spoken in the synagogue to that poor, deranged man. And then the wind ceased, and there was a dead calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And please notice, it's not doubt and faith that are the opposite in the Bible. It's fear and faith. Doubt is the cutting edge of the mind, wondering what's going on here. You're allowed to doubt, not get lost in it, but question, in other words, not just, because if you're not questioning, you're not getting anything. So it's fear that's the problem. And he says, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great awe and said to one another, "Who's this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Am I watching there a word description of a particular